There's marriage and then there's love marriage. That's the philosophy of Seema, the matchmaker at the center of the new Netflix reality series, Indian Matchmaking. And her focus is not helping you find love. It's arranging marriages for young people and their families based on everything from economic and social status to height. The show has gotten a lot of attention, but also some critiques. I'm Linda Holmes. We're talking about Indian matchmaking on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Joining us from Dubai is longtime NPR contributor and culture writer Bilal Qureshi. Hi, Bilal.
Hi, Linda.
And also joining us for the first time from her home in Brooklyn is food writer and author of the cookbook Indianish, Priya Krishna. Hi, Priya.
Hi, Linda. This is so exciting.
This is very exciting. And as I was telling you before we started taping, this is what you get for talking on your Instagram stories about Indian matchmaking. So if you're not familiar with Indian matchmaking, as we said, it follows this woman, Seema. It's created by a documentarian named Samarthi Mundra and showrun by JC Begley, who's done other reality show stuff like Ace of Cakes and things like that. It follows a group of Seema's arranged marriage clients and their families as she tries to kind of find suitable partners for them. Some of them live in India. Some of them live in other places. Bilal, how did you get into this show? What did you expect it to be when you first saw it?
Well, I ended up seeing it for the first time because everybody that is in my South Asian family WhatsApp groups or friend circles was immediately saying, have you seen? It's the only thing that it seemed everyone was talking about. You know, I think honestly, a lot of us are probably getting a little tired of the heavy. So I heard from a lot of people that it was just a fun sort of watch and the kind of light thing that you could enjoy. And so I heard about it a lot from friends from India because I had lived there for several years and they were all immediately obsessed. Yeah, and then, you know, I think if you grow up in a South Asian family, whether it's in South Asia or it's in America, like weddings are at the center of our lives. Like that is what defines our societies, our communities, our culture, our like movies. Every Bollywood movie seems to be centered around a big wedding spectacle. A lot of my like non-South Asian friends want to go to Indian weddings. It seems like there is this like automatic hook. And I thought in the beginning it seemed like just like a crazy Netflix show that's just fun to watch and forget about. But then you started seeing this wave of like, this show's really problematic. This show's making me really upset. This show's triggering me. This show is casteist, racist, sexist, all of these things. And so suddenly kind of the fun, frothy Netflix show turned into a think piece master generator. And so I found it to be something to continue watching and engaging with. And that's sort of how I got pulled into Indian matchmaking. Not actual matchmaking, but the show.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that's interesting is the filmmakers talked about the fact that because the focus is on Seema, the focus is on Seema's clients who are mostly well-off North Indian, Hindu, mostly Hindu people, which is not a cross-section of people who are Indian or South Asian. It's her particular client list. Priya, how did you go about watching this show?
Similar to Bilal, all of my WhatsApp groups were blowing up about this show, but I was surprised, equal to my WhatsApp group, my non-Indian friends were also asking me, have you seen this show? And I thought that was really interesting because I saw the show on like my Netflix queue and assumed it was a show meant for Indian Americans, but I very quickly realized this show had clearly found an audience far beyond the diaspora. So my first instinct when I watched it was like, is this show a great idea? Yes. Is this show highly entertaining? Yes. Is it really, really hard to watch? Yes. Like it's hard to see a show normalize casteism, sexism, colorism, and provide zero context for any of that. Like when I was talking to other people about it, I felt the need to like contextualize a lot of the conversations in the show. It's very upfront about everyone here is going to be able-bodied, they're going to be, you know, cis, heterosexual, and they're going to be fair-skinned, seeking other fair-skinned people out. And it's going to be just accepted that divorcees have a harder time. If you are Guyanese, you're going to have a harder time. Seema sort of just accepts that as fact without taking a step back to be like, oh, is it problematic? And it blazes through that so fast. There are many times in the show where I wish the show had just taken like an extra beat to provide explanation around that. And that explanation didn't need to be like a chart of like the caste system in India.
Right.
But I think even just having the interviewees and the cast members discussing, giving a little bit more of that context, I really could have used, because I think hearing that language is really troubling for a lot of people who've been discriminated against within their own community. But at the same time, you know, you watch this show and I felt like I know some of these aunties and uncles. I have seen colorism in action. I have seen this sexism in action. So like, while it is problematic, is there truth to a lot of the sort of problematic aspects to it? Yes. It is shining a light on like some of the worst parts of Desi society. And I think like, it's interesting for me because it left me wondering like, is it on the filmmaker to make a judgment call, or is it on the filmmaker to just present this matchmaker as she is, as problematic as she is, as problematic as many of her clients are, and allow the audience to sort of make that judgment for themselves?
Yeah. What do you think, Bilal?
I mean, so I had lived in India when Netflix first came out in 2016 and was launched in India, and I was living there at the time. What I remember hearing a lot was that they were planning to make a lot of shows that were not going to be necessarily catered to just the diasporas or to international audiences, but they have to cater to the Indian audiences as well. And that means that they don't actually have the same burden of representation on them that we typically seem to put on shows about people of color in a majority white society like America, which means that we want to put our best foot forward, show our best side, show ourselves as like the most amazing, cool people that you, I'm talking about like any sort of aggrieved or potentially marginalized minority community culturally. I love this show because I think it puts all the hot mess out there in public. And I think that is exactly the kind of culture we also need to be able to have, which is stuff that, as you said, Priya, like that auntie who's the center of the show, she's making no apologies for who she is. She is doing exactly what she does and she has a huge client list for it. I'm not saying that that means that the filmmaker couldn't have done more to provide more context, but I also think it is a little bit too real for some people, it seems to me, which I think is actually, I find really refreshing because I've actually get tired sometimes of like only representation that's supposed to make us feel better about ourselves. I think this is making a lot of people, brown people, South Asians, understand like that's what we're dealing with often in our communities and in our societies. And I find that it speaks to the fact that Netflix is also making this show for India as well. And people in India are like, yeah, this is our problem. I heard a lot of friends from Delhi saying like, Auntie Seema just keeps it real. That's how aunties are here. And I found that really kind of interesting new wave of representation that's like uncomfortable and in a way more honest sometimes, I feel.
But to your point, in the absence of robust representation of South Asians in America, I can understand why a lot of Indians were like, this is how people are going to understand arranged marriage. You know, as someone whose parents had an arranged marriage, I was like, oh God, am I going to get questions about my parents' arranged marriage? It sort of reminded me a lot of my white friends' mothers asking me when I was little if I was promised to anyone.
Boy.
In the same way that like things like Apu and Slumdog Millionaire sort of created all of these, people thought that they were connected to the Indian community in some way and they would meet another Indian and be like, Apu. Or like, ah, Slumdog Millionaire. Ugh. My first instinct watching this show was like, oh God, is this going to be the new Apu? Is this going to be the new Slumdog Millionaire? Are people going to be asking me if this is how it's going to work? Like, I was like, I wonder if that's like the audience for this. I don't know. It made me uncomfortable in a way, but of course there's truth to it. And I think to your point, Bilal, like the evolution of representation is really important. I was upset that there were no same-sex couples. I was upset that there were no Muslim couples. But, you know, in an interview with the executive producer, that executive producer just plainly said, those are not Seema's clients. Those are not people who hire her.
Can I just say, as a same-sex Muslim couple, like in my personal marriage, like this show was definitely not for me and about my community, or Muslims are certainly not anywhere in the show because she's dealing with upper caste Hindu families that are her client list.
Yeah.
And this is this filmmaker's show for Netflix, and it originated, actually, Auntie Seema has an origin story. She first appeared in a documentary called A Suitable Girl, which is the first film that this filmmaker made, which won lots of like critical acclaim and awards. And it's actually, to your point, Priya, like a really nuanced, interesting film about gender and marriage in India. Unfortunately, I think when sometimes Netflix brings in these kinds of people, she has said in interviews, they were like, amp up the froth, make it fun, make it basically addictive, sugary, binge-worthy show. A lot of people, unfortunately, didn't watch A Suitable Girl, but a lot of people have watched the show. And that also, I think, speaks partly to this model of distribution, which is creating something that's going to also be really fun. No matter what community it comes from, isn't that kind of the reality summer binge? It is going to be a little frothy, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things we've talked about on the show before is that one of the primary manifestations of privilege is not having to represent anyone except yourself and not having to have the work that you do represent anything except the work that it is. And the filmmaker said, and I get this totally, she's like, I did not want to sit around and get too explainy about colorism and casteism and stuff like that, because I wasn't primarily thinking about a non-South Asian audience. I was primarily thinking about a South Asian audience. And one of the things that occurred to me as I was thinking about this show is this is sort of a phenomenon of the global television show, right? Where, you know, if you watch a show that has this aspiration to be kind of for the whole world, and it is talking about a very specific person working in a very specific community, then it's very logical to both want, as the filmmaker, to just be true to that like one specific thing, and to be concerned about how it's going to be viewed around the world by a lot of other people. I do think there's some truth to what Bilal says, that if you're a documentary filmmaker who has really serious ideas about what you want to say, it is possible for those things to get very lost in the translation of that into a format of a Netflix dating show. Because really, in format, it feels to me exactly like a Netflix dating show, like Dating Around or something like that, where you kind of get, like, for example, Aparna, who is this kind of very, she's sort of set up like this somewhat bossy, demanding lawyer who doesn't like anybody and she's too picky and all that stuff. Or you have like this very nice guy who's a teacher who seems like the only guy who's really into it, I have to say.
Yasser.
Yeah, Yasser. And some of the men really seem like what they've internalized is like, it's my job to get married, whereas the women have more internalized, I need to get married in order to be a whole person, you know?
Yeah, it truly was like a lot of the women, it was like, I've tried everything else and I just need to feel whole and complete. And the men were like, my mom is nagging me to get married, so I guess I need to get married. But none of them seemed like particularly jazzed about getting married. Like, oh my gosh, Akshay, his mom was like, if you don't get married by this month, I'm literally just going to choose someone for you and you will marry that person. What was her name? Preeti Auntie. Preeti. Oh my gosh.
And she's like, you're making my blood pressure go up and, you know,
her BP.
You
can't.
She is placing a lot of pressure on him.
To Priya, your point, it's generated so many memes like around the show and like within South Asian, like Twitter, Instagram stuff. Like every person, there's an Aparna like meme for everything when you want to throw an Aparna diss to someone. Or I think what that speaks to too from a format perspective is it reminds me of one of those like perfectly cast hot mess of like a real world show. I kept wondering, how did she choose these particular people? Because they appear over various episodes, which is also kind of interesting because you see some of them actually matched with other people in the cast who some people have not accepted or whatever.
Right.
So in a way, it has this kind of ensemble. And I find the ensemble itself is like amazing because it's these people are perfect for reality TV, I suppose, in some ways.
And I think like if you look at the cast of Indian Matchmaking vis-a-vis, you know, who they choose for Bachelor, Bachelorette, any other reality TV show, it's cast in the exact same way. You've got your villains, you've got the people who you're supposed to root for, you've got your like absurd people, your mama's boys, like, you know, you've got the whole spectrum of folks that you would expect in a reality TV show.
Yeah, I think it's very well cast from the standpoint of making you interested in it. Like I've talked to so many people who have found it just, you know, the TV equivalent of an unputdownable book.
Yeah.
And some of the pleasures of it for me were the same as they are on other silly dating shows. Like you see this woman, Nadia, go on this date with this dude and they're like, oh, you don't like ketchup? I don't like ketchup. And it becomes this big thing they're going to bond over. Like neither one of them has ever met anyone who doesn't like ketchup before. And it's just one of those strange, like quirky things that happens with people. And I did enjoy that part of it very much.
And I think the other part that's really funny is that, like, Seema is very upfront that, like, you know, true love, romance is not a part of her equation. Like, in India, there's literally another word. It's arranged marriage and love marriage. And love marriage, I find this so annoying, but it's, like, also kind of hilarious that, like, love marriage means, like, you selected this partner, they were not arranged, as if an arranged marriage can never be,
right?
You can never be in love. Akshay goes on this date with this woman who ends up becoming his fiance. They exchange maybe like 5 words in the entire date. And then it like cuts to him being like, yes, she's the one.
I think one of the things that's really funny to me is that a lot of people seem to be, the aunties kind of points to this new kind of millennial digital generation that's the cast is like, a lot of them are just exasperated. They're like, I've tried the apps, I've done the thing. Like, could the aunties be making like a return in a major way other places too? Because there are a lot of people that I feel in communities and cultures outside of ours too, where there's conversations happening around like, it's really hard with the apps and dating and whatever. And ultimately, you know, the question I think at the center of the show too is like, do you have to get married? Like, do you have to find a partner? Which I think is running through a variety of things in culture. In this case, there's a pressure to do so. But a lot of people are also tired because they've tried every technique and this was kind of the last resort. And the auntie is there to be like, y'all need to get your priorities right. There is no love. There's just Auntie Seema. And she's going to tell you who you marry.
I think my favorite part to that point was the vignettes at the beginning of each episode where they interview couples who have done arranged marriages. And they speak in very plain terms about their marriage and this idea that like marriage isn't necessarily this big romance, but rather a partnership between families. And I found those to be just like so refreshing and so endearing.
Yeah, well, and I think a lot of them, it's clear that they do love each other. It's clear that there is a love between them. And I think some of the people who were going to Seema were fundamentally, ultimately looking for what those couples had, which is that they were looking for an arranged marriage that would also be a loving marriage. And some of them work very close to using Seema more like a supercharged dating app where she would find the person and then you would go and you would meet them and you would see if you sort of like hit it off or had a spark, as opposed to what I think Seema ideally thinks you should do, which is just go and basically like see if the person is okay. Sort of like what Akshay did. Like you go, you meet the person and basically do what he did, which is essentially like, this is fine.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that's sort of what she envisions. This is so much fun. I want to hear what all of you, if you've had a chance to watch Indian Matchmaking, which I know many of you have, find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of This Week and Every Week, What is Making Us Happy This Week. So come right back.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. Welcome to banking reimagined. Capital One checking and savings accounts have no fees or minimums and a top-rated banking app that lets you manage your money anytime, anywhere. Check on the account balance, deposit checks, pay bills, and transfer money on the go. This is banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One N.A., member FDIC. This message comes from NPR sponsor Vrbo. Summer is here, and vacation is just a drive away. Search thousands of nearby vacation rentals on Vrbo to find your family a private home all to yourselves, where you can spread out, chill out, and feel that vacation feeling again together. Book the home that makes the vacation. Download the Vrbo app. That's V-R-B-O.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Bilal Qureshi, what is making you happy this week?
What's making me happy this week actually is a new book by a journalist from South Africa called The Pink Line, because I just think it's very much addressing an issue I've been thinking about, which is the huge advances in LGBT rights that have happened over the last 10 years around the world, essentially. And this is a journalist who decided basically to travel around the world to look at how things around our idea of gender and sexuality have been changing globally. And it's just a really wonderful book. It's the kind of like big, ambitious book that tries to take in a huge decade of change. And I found it both really interesting and really illuminating. And I would really recommend it. It's called The Pink Line: Journeys Across the World's New Queer Frontiers by Mark Givisser. It's a book I've really, really liked and I would really recommend to everyone.
Oh, thank you very much, Bilal. Priya Krishna, what is making you happy this week?
What's making me happy this week is actually a recipe on the New York Times Cooking for strawberry spoon cake. And it is by a really talented recipe developer, Jarell Guy. It is a... It is like an ooey gooey cake that takes 10 minutes to put together. You drop in strawberries, you bake it, and it is like the easiest, most satisfying dessert that you think is for two, but is really just for one. I have made it with cherries, strawberries. You can make it with blackberries. You can make it with peaches. You know, when you reach that point of your day where like, you've made dinner, it's 8 o'clock, you have the rest of the night, but you can't do anything or do any social engagements because we're all still in quarantine. You can make this cake and sit on your couch and eat it and feel great. So that strawberry spoon cake by Jarell Guy on NYT Cooking is what is making me happy this week.
Love it. Love it. Thank you so much, Priya. What is making me happy this week? If you follow me on Twitter, you know that I spent this last weekend on a binge of 90s thrillers for some reason. Started off watching The Firm with Tom Cruise, watched some other Grisham, watched The Pelican Brief, watched The Rainmaker, watched The Client, and then I watched The Fugitive. The nice thing about movies like this is they are sort of the perfect balance for me between they're good, they're well made, but they're not terribly challenging from a content perspective. And also, you really can have quite a tour of what was going on with like men's shirts and pants at that time. Tom Cruise's shirts in The Firm are just huge. It was big pants and big shirts time. I love a tour through 90s fashion. So what is making me happy this week is just like wander through whatever streaming services you subscribe to, find some 90s thrillers with some trench coats and FBI and CIA and meetings in dark garages. Just enjoy those because that is 100% what is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Bilal at BQILAL. You can find Priya at Priya Krishna. You can find producer Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy and producer Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides the music you're bobbing your head to right now. Thanks so much to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was great.
And thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. If you have a second, subscribe to our newsletter. It's at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. We will see you all right back here next week where we will be talking about Beyoncé's visual album, Black is King.
Until recently, Edmund Hong says he didn't speak out against racism because he was scared.
My parents told me not to speak up because they were scared. But I'm tired of this.
Listen now on the Code Switch podcast from NPR.